is commanded.
Please be seated. Good afternoon. We're delighted to see you all. And let me make some special introductions. We have students from Granton High School. Would they please stand? Thank you. And your instructor attended the Teachers Institute in 2003, and we're delighted about that, a very important part of our program with students. And we have students here from Durand High School. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming. And I have a very special guest who is the father of my law clerk, Mr. John Trinetsky. Welcome to you, Mr. Trinetsky. Thank you for coming. The students are here with a program called Court with Class, where the students are invited to attend an oral argument, and if the school accepts that invitation, the students will come to an oral argument. They will have received the briefs and the case they're about to hear, and they may have engaged in some activities relating to the case. I don't know whether you were able to come for lunch during lunch hour today and visit with the justice, were you? Good. Part of the program is that after the second oral argument in the morning, the students meet with a justice, and everyone else would have been invited too, had you known. And the discussion is had as to the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues in the case. Before I introduce the court to you all, if you would like a summary of this case, the marshal can give you one. It is easier to listen to the case if you know the facts or summary. If you'd raise your hand if you'd like a summary, we'll give you one. There we go. Raise your hand high, please, so we can deal with that. Good. While these summaries are being distributed, I would like to introduce the court to you all. Starting on my far left is Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate left is an empty chair, and ordinarily Justice Ann Walsh Bradley sits there. She will not be participating in this case. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox. To his right, Justice Patrick Crooks. And on the far right is an empty chair, and ordinarily Justice Patience Robensack would sit there, but she is not participating. I will call the case 05-AP-2743, Aaron T. Rouse versus Theda Clark Medical Center et al. Before I call on counsel, I would like to advise counsel that I do have a connection with one of the defendants, namely the university hospitals. It's a very attenuated connection, but I am revealing it in full disclosure. I do not view these connections as obliging me to recuse myself, either on the grounds that I am partial or that it would appear that I am partial, but counsel should listen carefully. If you disagree with my decision, you can so write me. I know the head of the hospital, Donna Sollinger, and see her periodically at a dinner club, probably 3 to 5 times a year. I have, since I've come to Madison 45-plus years ago, generally used the university hospitals as my medical care. My husband is a former professor, but not in the medical school or at the hospital, but he is on a patient advisory board in the urology department. I am familiar with several of the regents and with John Wiley, the chancellor of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and Kevin Riley, the president of the University of Wisconsin. I believe that is a full disclosure, and I sayeth no more at the moment. So with that, I will, do you have any objection at the, right now? Okay.
Well, Chief Justice, if you're going, you're making...
How do you feel?
I hadn't intended to make any disclosures, okay. But you, a couple of those you hit on, obviously...
how do you feel, John? Pretty good?
I'm partial on this, but I would say that I have some contacts with the hospital, and I certainly know some of the people that work there, and the same as you had recited. So I feel that personally no reason for accusing, but I just, as long as we're doing this, as sometimes we do when we have insurance people up here, we have to make disclosures. That would be my disclosure.
But our medical records are confidential, counsel.
That's right.
Well, I'd like to disclose that I have no contacts with the hospital.
As of now.
As of now.
Okay. All right. With that, I'm going to ask Attorney J. Michael End, who represents the plaintiff, appellant petitioner, Aaron T. Rouse, to approach the podium and begin his oral argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Van Sicklin, members of the court, this is what I perceive to be an important case for those people who happen to be injured as a result of medical negligence at the University Hospital when the negligence is that of a resident. It's a very limited number of people, but for those people, in my opinion, it's a very important issue. I would also like to apologize at the outset for the failure on my part to bring to the court's attention at the outset the Reineck decision. It's a very well-known decision in medical malpractice in Wisconsin. When I filed this lawsuit, I got the brief from the other side saying that we should be dismissed because of the fact that we hadn't complied with the statute requiring notice, and we just fought that issue all the way here until a couple of weeks ago, and I got the brief from the Wisconsin Academy of Trial Lawyers, and lo and behold, the bell rung for me. And this case, I think, can be decided on that narrow issue set forth in the Reineck decision. This is a Chapter 655 case. We filed it as a Chapter 655 case, and as the brief from the Wisconsin Academy of Trial Lawyers demonstrates very clearly, the authority has, from its outset in 1996, considered itself to be a Chapter 655 entity. It has purchased the primary insurance coverage.
As I understood the brief, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but as I understood the brief, you might have at least two types of physicians, maybe other health care providers, and that if the physician is connected with, is a faculty member at the University of Wisconsin Medical School, that that person is not a 655, but is a is an employee of the state, if I understood the brief. But you should correct
absolutely.
Me.
Absolutely. You're absolutely correct.
But if the physician and other health care providers, and I just don't know enough about how the university works, whether you have people in the medical school that are not physicians that work at the hospital, so they would fit under the government part, that if they are not at the medical school but are just hospital employees, that they are under 655 as presented by the hospital, but we only have the brief. I don't know that we've got the employment or whatever the brochure was that, from which it's quoted.
You're absolutely correct, Your Honor. And our lawsuit was not against any faculty members. We did not sue any state employees. The only people we did sue are the resident doctors who are employees of the authority. And that's really what we're here today talking about, is whether or not the authority is entitled to the benefits of Section 893.80. And after I got the amicus brief from the Wisconsin Academy of Trial Lawyers, it dawned on me that because this is a Chapter 655 case, and because of the Reinick decision, and also the Jelinek decision, which followed Reinick by 4 years, the legislature enacted Chapter 655 so that there would be a separate way of handling medical malpractice cases in Wisconsin.
UW Medical School doctors excluded under 655?
Absolutely.
Expressly?
Absolutely. It's right in Chapter 655, Your Honor, that employees of the state of Wisconsin, meaning all faculty members at University Hospital, are not subject to Chapter 655. And they are protected.
I think you may have misspoke.
Oh, did I? I'm sorry.
You said all employees of the University of Wisconsin Hospital.
I meant of the University of Wisconsin. Thank you,
Medical
Your Honor.
School. Okay. I'm sorry to have interrupted you.
So the dichotomy here is that the faculty member doctors are protected by Section 893.82, which says that employees of the state have a maximum liability of $250,000, and they have the notice provision set forth in that section of the statutes that does not apply to the employees of the authority, the residents or the other employees.
Only that's true if you're right. It's not necessarily true, because your opponent is going to say that everyone employed at the hospital is everyone that fits healthcare provider is going to be under the government, not immunity, but the notice statute, the statutory immunity.
There are two statutes. The one that we were just talking about with the doctors, the attending doctors who are state employees, 893.82
right. That's
requires
the notice. Right.
And that's not part of this case.
Right.
But the part of the case, and actually the position of the authority, is not that they are state people. It's that they, as an authority, are protected by the provisions of 893.80. And so in that statute, the notice has to be given, and the maximum recovery is $50,000. And they are, in fact, within Chapter 655 of the statutes, as the brief from the Wisconsin Academy of Trial Lawyers shows. They have been paying the primary care insurance premiums to Physicians Insurance Company of Wisconsin and St. Paul throughout the entire time from 1996 until now. They have been paying their fund assessments throughout that time, so that they have admitted that they belong within the program of Chapter 655, and that's where the Reinick decision comes to play, because the court in the Reinick decision, in a unanimous decision, held that Chapter 655 is something separate from other tort claims, and we do not look outside of Chapter 655 in order to, and in that case, as you know, it was a wrongful death case. The issue was whether the wrongful death cap in 895.04, which at that time was $50,000, whether that applied or whether the $1 million cap in Chapter 655 applied, and the Supreme Court said it's the $1 million cap, and if the legislature had wanted to do something different, they could have said so and incorporated the wrongful death cap. And so my reading of that case, and also the following case of Jelinek, which I think is important because in Reinick, there was the $1 million cap in Chapter 655. So the court said, we're going to hold that the $1 million cap applies. In Jelinek, there was no longer a cap. The cap had expired. And the court still, with no cap at all in Chapter 655, held as our holding that the cap in 895.04, the wrongful death general statute, does not apply because Chapter 655 was intended by the legislature to be a separate method by which people who are injured by medical malpractice can get recovery for their injuries.
Mr. And, how do you explain then the fact that 893.80.1M extends the period of time from 120 days for notice to 180 days for notice in a medical malpractice situation? If there's no connection, how is that explained?
Well, there is a connection.
Let me explain
sure. If I might. The only people who are exempt from Chapter 655 are the state employees, the attending doctors at the university hospital. So any other doctor, if I file a lawsuit against a doctor in Milwaukee, and that won't apply to this.
Well, if you divide...
I can give you an example, Your Honor. I'm sorry. There are two hospitals we know of, and it's in the brief, that are county-owned hospitals. And if a county-owned hospital is sued for malpractice, then this section of the statutes, 893.80, clearly does apply because that's a county hospital that's at issue here.
Well, the hospitals you're talking about are mentioned in the Lewis case, are they not?
Yes.
So you think that that's the only significance to 1M, is that it would relate to those two hospitals?
Yes.
But in the Lewis case, in the footnote that you're referencing, it covers not only those two county hospitals, but also covers University of Wisconsin Hospital and Clinics Authority. So doesn't that tie it back in as well?
What the footnote actually said, and this is in the Wisconsin Academy of Trial Lawyers brief that was filed a couple weeks ago. They have, and we do in our brief as well, we have a couple, lists of hospitals in Wisconsin where the University of Wisconsin Hospital and Clinics Authority is listed as a privately owned entity. It's not connected with the state. And the exact footnote in the Lewis case says, excluding special psychiatric hospitals, currently there are only three government-owned facilities, which is absolutely correct. The facility, the University of Wisconsin Hospital building, is owned by the state of Wisconsin and leased by the authority. So that in reality, this was a correct statement, but it didn't have bearing, in my opinion, on, and in fact, the issue never was even here in this case relating to the authority in any, whether it was a governmental entity or not.
I thought your brief was very interesting in that, and I think I've got the right pages, about pages 6 to 10 of your brief, you set forth an analysis that had been done by the Legislative Reference Bureau. And that analysis sets forth a lot of the characteristics, if you will, of UWHCA. And when I got done reading the list, my reaction was, now how do we apply a test, or what kind of balancing test do we apply to these characteristics
Do you have any suggestion in that regard?
My opinion, Your Honor, is that this is an extremely complicated issue because the authority, and we admit, has many characteristics of a public entity. I mean, it was started by the state of Wisconsin. It's supervised by the state of Wisconsin. It also has many characteristics that are not governmental. It's a hospital. And I think the point that we tried to make in our brief is that if you are trying to determine whether the authority is protected by Section 893.80, you have to look at the intent of that statute and whether the authority falls within the intent of the people in the legislature who started and enacted that statute. And I hope that we made it clear in our brief, and I don't know if we did or not, but this is a hospital. And in fact, the Takel case, the Seventh Circuit Federal Court, said this is not a governmental entity by any stretch of the imagination. This is a health care facility, and that's what it is. And my belief is that it's a stretch for the authority to be claiming that they're protected by Section 893.80 when, for one thing, they're buying liability insurance of $1 million primary coverage. They're paying their fund assessment. They've got insurance coverage to the extent of $741 million with the fund. And their claim is we're protected to $50,000. It doesn't make sense.
The Takel case was one that initially I thought, this is really going to be helpful to us. Then I looked at that opinion, and the opinion talks about sovereign immunity rather than governmental immunity. So that it became far less persuasive to me when I realized that. Don't you think that those are very distinct concepts, sovereign immunity and governmental immunity?
I believe that they are, although the court, the Seventh Circuit, clearly in its opinion stated this is not, this entity, the authority, does not have any governmental properties whatsoever. It's a health care provider. But you're absolutely right. In that case, 2 years ago, the same authority that we're talking about now, who's claiming that they're not part of the state of Wisconsin, but they're a separate entity protected by the statute, there, 2 years ago, they're saying, oh, we're part of the state of Wisconsin. We're sovereign immunity. You can't have it both ways. Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. N., how does the Scarpacci analysis fit into this?
And what
the Scarpacci case involved wasn't it
a medical examiner?
Medical examiner in the city of Milwaukee, and the medical examiner, I think clearly a governmental agency, performed medical functions in a way that were not adequate.
Right. And I think the point of that case is that if a doctor or a nurse, for that matter, injures a patient by medical negligence, that is not considered to be a function of government. I think the point of this...
quasi-legislative or quasi-judicial, I think, is the decision.
Yes. And what that case said is we can't consider the governmental definitions in 893.80 for healthcare providers who are negligent. They, as being negligent healthcare providers, have to stand under the medical malpractice arena in the state of Wisconsin.
Well, everyone agrees, do they not, that to the extent if there were medical malpractice, there is liability. Aside from the notice, everybody agrees. The disagreement, as I understand it, comes in as to whether they're protected because the appropriate notice was not given in the appropriate time. So the issue here is, did notice have to be given? If it didn't, you just have to comply with the statute of limitations, right?
Absolutely.
All right. So, as I understand the case, You've got 893.80, which deals with a political corporation or a government subdivision or agency thereof. And you could, your defendants, or defendant, the University of Wisconsin Hospitals and Clinic, might be considered a governmental subdivision or a political corporation, right? That's what you're fighting about.
Absolutely.
Okay. If so, if they were, then you'd come under 893.80. You'd have to have given 120 notice, day notice, and or under 1M, it might have been extended somewhat. Or there's been mention of 893.82. Right? That is a claim against a state officer or employee or agent.
Yes.
And another way that this might be looked at is that this is a claim against a state employee.
No.
You're not looking at it that way.
No.
Is the other side looking at it that way?
No.
No. So 82 is not in the picture.
It's not in the case because we did not sue any of the attending doctors. We sued no state employees.
All right. Just the hospital employees.
And the residents.
Okay. But that provision also has a medical malpractice under 5M. So under both, you've got the same kind of notice and extension requirements. All right.
Right.
So under 893.80. And so, as I understand, the fight is whether the hospital is a political corporation. Is that right?
That would be the fight if we ignore the argument that because this is Chapter 655, that does not apply. And my argument is that if the legislature thought that 893.80 should apply to the authority, when they created the authority in 1995, they would have put in that legislation, oh, and by the way, if you're going to bring a medical malpractice case against the authority, you have to comply with the requirements in Section 893.80. They would have put it there.
Mr. Ann, I'm not sure they did. Maybe I'm having the same trouble that Justice Crooks had. When I look at 893.80.1M, it relates back. You can't look at it in isolation. It relates back to 1A. And when it relates back to 1A, 1A is the one that sets the notice of 120 days for a claim signed by the party, agent, or attorney is served on the, and the operative term here is political corporation, governmental subdivision, or agency, and on the officer, official, agent, or employee under 80111. And it says in 1M, with regard to a claim to recover damages for medical malpractice, the time period under 1A shall be extended. So when you read the two together, this statute clearly contemplates medical malpractice. It relates it back to political corporations. And I'm having the same problem that Justice Crooks had. Well, then why doesn't this apply under this setting?
Why doesn't it apply into what? I'm sorry, Ms.
Why does it not apply to the UW?
And
I can never get all the acronyms together. UWHCA, the authority.
It doesn't because unless 893.80 applies, in other words, this would apply to the county-owned hospital. Okay? A case is brought against the county-owned hospital. There's no question but that the hospital is considered to be a governmental entity, and because it's medical malpractice, the 120 days becomes 180 days for filing the notice.
But as I understand the Waddell brief, and I'm looking at it, it's right on page 9, Chapter 655 provides the exclusive procedures for the prosecution of malpractice claims against a health care provider. So it would seem to me that 655, if it covers everything and if it's exclusive, then that wouldn't that cover malpractice claims against health care providers for county?
The reason it doesn't is that Chapter 655, by its terms, excludes state employee physicians and county doctors.
That's 655.003 sub 1. Is that what you're referring
yes,
to,
I am.
Counsel?
Thank you.
And it's our position that, you know, they've been paying Chapter 655 for 11 years now. They are part of Chapter 655, so we don't look to 893.80 because that does not apply. That's the position that when I read the Waddle brief, I said, holy cow, you know, they're right under Reinick.
Well, because 655.03 says a physician or nurse anesthetist, who is a state, county, or municipal employee or federal employee and who is acting within the scope of employment is not covered under 655. So your position is that these residents or doctors that are not part of UW Medical School are not state, county, or municipal employees. They are employees of the authority. And the authority is not the state. The authority is not the county. And the authority is not a municipality. So it may very well be, if I understand your argument, a political corporation under 89380, but the doctors, or at least anyone that's a health care provider here, is not covered.
Actually,
is that your position?
Almost. My position is the residents and the authority are not part of 893.80 because they're part of Chapter 655. And they've been paying that. They've admitted that they do not belong here because they've admitted that they're in Chapter 655. And they're governed by that chapter of the statutes which was enacted to carry all of the cases other than state employees or these local governmental entities, and they've admitted by paying those premiums and the assessments to the fund that they are not covered by 893.80.
Well, where is the resident covered? If 655.002 talks about applicability.
The residents are actually licensed physicians. And once they're licensed, then they're considered to be a health care provider under Chapter 655. And there was one of these four residents who had not been licensed yet, but then he becomes an employee of the authority, which is under Chapter 655.
Just hypothetically, if this is not under 893.80 and you set aside 655, how do you get past the notice requirement? Is this the kind of thing that the employees knew there was malpractice? Or give me an answer, please.
The answer is the notice provisions of 893.80 do not apply because they were not incorporated into Chapter 655 exactly as the Reinick decision. In Reinick, there was 895.04 with a 50,000 cap for wrongful death. In 655, there was $1 million limit. And the Supreme Court said, we're not going anywhere near 895.04 because Chapter 655 was started to cover medical malpractice cases in Wisconsin. That's the sole way. If the legislature had wanted to do something with that $50,000 cap, all they had to do was do it. They had to say something like, we want a maximum of $50,000 for wrongful death, but we still have the $1 million limit. They didn't do it, and the court held the $1 million cap applied. And then they followed up that case with the Jelinek case where there was no cap. So now you don't even have a contending issue. And the court held Chapter 655 is the way in which people injured by medical negligence recover in Wisconsin. And we're not, from now on, there's no cap for wrongful death damages for medical malpractice. And then the legislature eventually enacted some legislation to place a cap on it. So that's, you know, basically that's our position, that they're a Chapter 655 entity. that the legislature did not say anything about giving notice, and they didn't say anything about, and the $50,000 cap will apply in a Chapter 655 proceeding. And so our position is we don't have to do that because we're filing a Chapter 655 case against Chapter 655 people.
Thank you, Counsel. You'll have 5 minutes in a rebuttal.
Thank you.
Your red light's on. That's why I'm saying that. Attorney Michael B. Van Sicklin of Foley and Lardner, representing UW Hospitals and Clinics Authority. Mr. Van Sicklin.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court. As you know, I'm Mike Van Sicklin from the Madison Office of Foley and Lardner. It's my privilege to represent the six respondents. We're pleased to be supported in our position today by the two amicus, the State of Wisconsin, which has weighed in support of our position on the constitutionality of the statute, and by the University of Wisconsin System, which has weighed in our support on the claim notice issue. Given that opening argument, it's hard to know where to start. I had planned to follow the briefs and the issues that have been raised in a timely way up through the course of this proceeding, but I will start by addressing what Mr. End has raised for the first time as a surprise to me, even though it sounds like he was aware of it for a few weeks. I think this is a much more complicated issue than he would suggest. First off, he would read right out of the statutes 89381M as the justices.
Well, there are other medical people that are connected with local government. You've got psychologists working in various departments for the county government, or we're under 80, right, not 83, so I don't have to deal with the state. You had medical examiners. I think that was a Milwaukee County person. You got doctors at mental hospitals. I was getting the Veterans Hospital, got them in prisons, part-time or full-time. So 1M fits. And you're not the only doctors in town.
Right.
Or there's in the state.
Two categories of doctors here. There's the 0.82, the state-employed doctor,
right,
which also has a 1M.
Yeah, they're comparable, as
right.
I read them.
And the whole issue of to what extent and whether Chapter 655 supplants the notice provisions that the legislature has put in place under 89380 is further complicated when you look at the carve-out that you referenced, Chief Justice. To Chapter 655.
You'll have to stand in front of the microphone, please.
But when you look at 655.003, it carves out a number of things, including facilities that are exempt under Section 50.39 or operated by any governmental agency. And when you look at Chapter 50.39, it carves out a whole number, broad range of hospitals from the application, including, if you look at the definitional sections, anything run by what's called in 50.331r, a governmental unit, which means, as defined here, the state, any county, town, city, village, or other political subdivision, or any combination thereof, department, division, board, or other agency of any of the foregoing.
Where does the authority fit?
I think it gets right back to our core argument that when this issue gets boiled down, the key inquiry for the court is, are we more of a public entity, a public corporation, or a private one? And if we are a public corporation, we are, as defined by the legislature, a body politic, corporate, and a public body, corporate and politic, that makes us within the broad governmental.
Are you covered by 655 or not? Anybody at the hospital?
It's really something that I've not had a chance to really consider, research, and brief. I think that a number of people clearly are. It raises this whole Phelps
UW
issue.
UW Medical School, okay. Anybody else?
Medical school faculty are covered by 0.82. They're state employees.
Because the medical school is a state
entity. We have
staff,
orderly, we have unlicensed professionals at the hospital who I think, would be covered. They're not. They're outside of 655.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think you have the folks that are health care providers.
And are they covered by 655?
I think they are covered, but I don't think it's exclusive in terms of the notice provisions that the legislature can put in place.
You think you can be covered by 655, but also covered by 89380?
Yes. I think the legislature can impose both parallel sets of provisions. And here they're not inconsistent.
Mm-hmm. Court has so stated that although it's exclusive, it doesn't cover everything about doctors.
It raises, for instance, the interesting debate the court had in Finnegan and Felt and Pierce about whether it's an independent action or there's lots of different ways in which they can be complementary.
Let's say I'm sick and I go to St. Mary's Hospital here in Madison and there's some malpractice. I don't have any time period except the regular statute of limitations in which to file a claim or file a lawsuit or something. But if I decide to go to a university hospital or some is it Meritor that's connected? Or then everything changes. How am I even supposed to know that?
Well, I think it's no different, Your Honor, than if you're in a car accident and the vehicle's being driven in the scope of the duties of a state employee or of a political corporation employee versus getting hit by a car driven by a privately employed driver, is there's a different set of rules, and the legislature for many, many years, as long as we've been a state, has deemed it appropriate to impose certain additional protections to different types of governmental bodies, both state employees on a sovereign immunity basis and subdivisions such as a political corporation protected by 893.80. And this court has repeatedly embraced and complemented the wisdom of having these claim notice provisions that add a layer of protection for political corporations. And they serve beneficial purposes. And yes, it can be difficult, but that's why people go to lawyers, is to be well advised. And there's a difference when you're an injured party and the tort is committed by an employee of a public corporation or an employee of a private corporation. And unless we're going to set aside that historic, long-recognized distinction, it's as equally applicable if you're the victim of medical malpractice as any other kind of negligence.
Well, I think you know, if you've read some of my dissents, that I think governmental immunity has been far too broad. But I keep losing on that. Nonetheless, even those people who are very happy with the present doctrine say there is an exception, the Scarpacci exception that the Chief just referenced and that always appears in the cases. And that seems to be involved professional activity in the nature of medicine, medical practice some way. Why doesn't that apply here? Why doesn't that send the signal of how this should be decided?
It wasn't mentioned in Lewis, which applied the statute.
Brilliant footnote, no doubt, but
can't be thought out. Watch it. We have a colleague here.
All right, you can come back at me. Come back.
It's not been ever held that these statutes, I mean, the statute in 893.80(1)(m) expressly applies in the medical malpractice context. And if that had no relevance and no application under the Scarpacci exception, you have competing principles there. But I think it is a reasonable exercise of the legislative wisdom to put that in.
It seems to me, and we talked about this, if you go to King, just right outside of Wapaka, there is a medical component there. They treat people there. You go to a prison, you see a sort of a clinic there. There are people lying there. There are all kinds of situations where hardcore government employees are practicing medicine, and these things make sense. But here, you're saying anybody come in, use our facilities, why should they be treated so differently from if they go to any other hospital?
Well, why should they be treated differently than a county hospital? What's unique about the University Hospital Authority is that, unlike any private hospital, it's a creature of statute. It was defined by statute. It serves specifically defined public purposes by statute. It must file an annual report with the governor, both houses of the legislature, and the Board of Regents to show its fulfillment of those public mandated public purposes each year. It has to put those public purposes in both its lease and affiliation agreement with the university, and it has to every third year get reviewed on fulfillment of those public purposes. It must donate millions of dollars a year in furtherance of the university medical school operations and the like. It fulfills a whole host of statutorily mandated publicly, public purposes that the state has deemed beneficial. And in that sense, it's very different than a private hospital. The UW Hospital Authority has no private ownership. It is a government entity, as this court found in Lewis. And if you look on the webpage today, the 2007 listing by the Department of Health and Family Services continues to list it as being government-owned. It's a different entity than Meritor Hospital or any other private institution. The chart on pages 36 to 43 of my brief shows 59 different public characteristics that define the University Hospital Authority, none of which are shared by private hospitals in the state. It's a very different entity. And it's very much in line with what this court found in a number of cases, like every single time the legislature has defined what it wanted to consider a public corporation, it's defined it as, quote, a public body, corporate and politic. And every time it's done so, whether it's being a town, a city, a village, a legal authority, this court has found that that is a political public corporation, different than a private entity. You found that in the Majerus decision involving the Armory, which was defined the same way as the UW Hospital Authority. You found it in the Earl case regarding an authority. You found it in the Nussbaum case regarding the Wisconsin Housing Finance Authority. You found it in the Townsend case, which dealt with a exposition department. And there's not a single instance in which an entity defined by our legislature as a public body, corporate and politic, has ever been found by this court to be anything other than a public corporation.
Don't you have to ask that question, for what purpose? It's a political corporation. For what purpose? For some purposes, it's not, right? It's excluded. It's not.
You're exactly right, Your Honor, and that's Counsel for Rouse points to these private purposes served by the authority. It says it has the right to sue and be sued, has the right to buy and sell real estate, hire employees and the like. But you know what? That's true of every single entity covered by 89380. Cities, villages, towns have that. You found in a long quote that's in the trial court's opinion in this case, at his appendix, page 25, in the Nussbaum case, that notwithstanding every one of those private types of powers that are identical to the one here, it was a Wisconsin authority just like this one, you found that it did not impair or override its fundamentally public purposes. You look at 223.02 sub 4, it statutorily lays out those public purposes for the university hospital that no private hospital has in the state.
But we're asking under 89380 to be read with Chapter 655 that deals with certain physicians. How do these two fit together? And how do they fit together with this is a special kind of entity, right?
And I think frankly, I've been sort of surprised by this issue today, but I think it's more complicated than it may appear. I think they can be read together and complementary, but I think even looking through just briefly while Mr. End was talking, the very complex definitions in Chapter 50, it's not at all clear to me that the carve-out that you see in 655 doesn't apply. Just looking at the definition I read from 50.33. So I do think if the court wishes to go off on this new issue, I would request the opportunity to have a chance to file a supplemental brief. But I do think that the two can run side by side. The court has not held that to be improper in other contexts.
If we were to interpret public body, corporate, and politic in this situation as not covering a political corporation, in other words, finding that UWHCA, even though designated as a public body, corporate, and politic, is not a public corporation, the briefs on both sides list a number of other organizations that are termed the same way by the legislature. Public body, corporate, and politic. What effect would this have as to other organizations?
It would have a significant effect, Your Honor. As I indicated, towns, villages, cities are all defined exactly the same, have very similar powers. All seven of the Wisconsin authorities which have been created, which I lay out in my brief, have exactly the same powers, are defined the same way.
Any of them under 655?
Pardon me?
Any of them under 655?
Not that I know of, Your Honor. I think they deal with a whole range of different subjects.
So if it was limited to 655 and its relation to 893, it might not affect any of them.
I was responding to
his
question.
Yeah, but that's what I'm asking you.
You could define it narrowly as a carve-out, but I think it would be inconsistent with your prior decisions, which have always found that these entities that the legislature deemed prudent to define as public bodies, corporate and politic, are in fact public, not private. And where they are public, they're entitled to the claim notice.
Did you check any legislative history as to 655, as to any reference in 655 relating to 89380?
I did not, because the issue hadn't ever been raised till just now. I'd be happy to do so. As the court knows, I've had a number of other cases up here involving 655, including Phelps, which parse out when it's applicable and when it isn't, and Pierce. I know enough to know it's an area of the law that requires some study. I will, I guess, touch in my last few minutes on just the constitutional issue. I think that Mr. Rouse faces two very large hurdles to bring that issue to the court. First, very significant procedural obstacles, the largest of which, of course, is that there is no set of facts under which addressing the constitutional issue in this case could ever be relevant to this case. Because if, in fact, the statute that he's claiming is unconstitutional applies, he failed to give the timely notice and his case is dismissed. If it doesn't apply, the constitutional issue is immaterial, obviously. Secondly, by raising it for the first time before this court, much as the issue we just raised now, the trial court and the Court of Appeals never had the opportunity to respond to it. We never had the chance to make an adequate record on the constitutional issue, and it sits before you in exactly the same posture that the same claim was made by a plaintiff in the Sams 2 case, where this court refused to address the constitutionality of this very same statute because the plaintiff had failed to timely raise it below. And the court explained the wisdom of not addressing an issue raised for the first time at this level. The other thing that even if you get by all of these procedural infirmities in Mr. Rausch's position on the constitutional issue, to do what he requests of the court, you would have to reverse three unanimous decisions of this court. You'd have to reverse Sams 3, you'd have to reverse Stanhope, and you'd have to reverse Lewis. Lewis being the most recent. You probably also have to substantially distance or qualify language by the majority in the Ferdin decision. In both Stanhope and Sams 3, you held that this very same statute had a rational basis and was constitutional. In Lewis, you applied it in the context of a medical malpractice case where there was a judgment several times greater than the cap. You said that it was within the legislative prerogative to set the cap, and you weren't going to second-guess the legislature. I think that's still wise today. In Ferdin, the majority said that the decision was narrow because it was focusing only on the cap on non-economic damages in 655, and it shouldn't in any way be suggested as questioning your other decisions, which had upheld the constitutionality of other caps, such as this one. And so, for all those reasons, I think the constitutional issue is meritless here, and that the real focus is on the application of 89380. I would note just one last thing. I think, Justice Crook, someone raised the Tackle decision, and I would submit that it's not on point, and if anything, supports our side, not Mr. Rausch's. The Seventh Circuit, through Judge Posner, addressed the issue there of whether the University Hospital Authority was entitled to sovereign immunity as an arm of the state. And the court said, no, it's much more like the entity in Majoris. And if you look at the decision by Judge Posner, he talks about the Majoris case, which, as you know, was a case like this one, where the court said, no, the armory is not an arm of the state, but it is defined as a public body, corporate, and politic. Therefore, you can bring a claim. It's not entitled to immunity, but to do so, you must do so in compliance with the notice provisions. So the Tackle case is entirely consistent with our position. So unless there's other questions, and if the court wants more information on whether the hospital is this whole 655 exclusivity issue, I would, request the opportunity to brief it if the court's going that direction.
Let me just ask you whether or not the brief of that's submitted by the Academy of Trial Lawyers, is their statement of the what the brochure says correct?
As to listing it as a non-governmentally owned hospital?
And no, as to whether how the employees are treated under 655, and that it has coverage under 655 and has insurance with Wisconsin Physician Services, which is with Physicians Insurance, which is one of the named defendants.
I think there's. I'm glad you raised that. I guess a couple of answers. One is on the question of what is the significance of the fact that the residents that are at issue here had, paid fund coverage or had, primary coverage from Physicians Insurance Company. I submit several things, that it's not relevant. In Sams 3, you held that the ability of the entity to purchase liability insurance is not a factor in determining what type of entity it is. Secondly, it's a practical reality of the job marketplace that we're living in this era in recent years of the medical malpractice crisis and uncertainty about the constitutionality of these provisions and what's going to be challenged, that no employer like the University Hospital Authority could get professional staff, nurses, residents, and the like, unless it had the backup protection of coverage. Here, for instance, if you were to deem these people not, you struck down the constitutionality of the provision. You did what Mr. Rouse asked. If we did not have protection, these people would be left unprotected. And so,
but you didn't have to get it through 655. There's other protection on the market.
Do it either way.
Well, but 655 says it doesn't cover state and local employees.
Well, again, there's a whole lot of facts about whether and to what extent and why they purchased it, that because it was raised for the first time in an amicus brief filed after we briefed the case.
It was filed April 5th of this month, Counsel.
But the
I recognize your difficulty.
Yeah. is well, it's a sandbagging. That's, we weren't given the chance to put things in the record that addressed it or brief it or the like. And
why I'm asking you the question.
And that's why I'm trying to answer it. I'd also note that they raised there this issue about the hospital has identified itself as not being governmentally owned, and therefore Lewis should be changed. Well, if you actually look at the materials in their appendix, I think that's not a fair characterization. At what this was, and if you look at their Waddell appendix, it starts at D17 of their appendix. It's a questionnaire sent to hospitals like the UW, and we were given the chance at page D19 to designate ourselves as a state-owned, county-owned, city-owned, religious, or other. And we chose other because we're not owned by the state or city or county. We're a political corporation. And so the answer that we gave when you look at the what they say is so damning about the answer we gave at page D30, that we identify ourselves as being other, is entirely consistent with the listing that you referred to in the Lewis case, which is updated every year, including just 2 weeks ago it was updated by the Department of Health and Family Services, and we're listed as government-owned. You can be government-owned and not be owned by the state, county, city. It's as simple as that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Van Sicklen. Council? Mr. End?
I'll try to answer a couple of the questions that were asked. And one, point in the Takel decision, the Federal Seventh Circuit, the court in Takel said, so far we are describing the privatization of a formerly public function. There is nothing inherently governmental about a hospital. They go on to say many private entities operate on public land or in public buildings. Consider concessionaires and airports, which is the situation here, where the authority leases the building from the state. The court goes on to say, what we have then is a state's creation of a private entity, with the state using its leverage as the creator of the entity to insist that it serve the state's interests as well as its own.
I was looking at the brief, I strike that the amicus of the Board of Regents, and they set out that the UW Hospital is somewhat unique in the sense that it is basically, it's a teaching hospital. It's where the people learn learn to be physicians, surgeons, et cetera, et cetera. Is not that the difference between this hospital and the hospital up in Wild Rose, Wisconsin, or the hospital in Beaver Dam? Is it a difference?
Let's compare comparable hospitals. Let's look at the Medical College of Wisconsin, a teaching hospital whose functions are identical to the University of Wisconsin authorities. And we put that in our brief. They have the same thing. The governor gets to appoint one-third of the trustees. They are required to do all sorts of the same things that the authority is required to do. Does that make the Medical College of Wisconsin a public authority? No, it doesn't. And I just want to raise one other thing, if you don't mind. In that, there is a paper that was attached as an exhibit in the Waddell. It's called Liability Protection for Health Professionals at UW Health. And they say, there is no limit on the amount of coverage under the Wisconsin Patient Compensation Fund. And they say, I'm reading at the Waddell Appendix B7. And then what I find is very telling on this whole issue is, in that paper they say, the amount recoverable against an individual state employee, in other words, an attending doctor, trainee or student by one claimant is limited to $250,000. So in this publication put out 2 years ago by the authority, they're saying we have unlimited protection for you if you're an employee of the authority. If you're a state employee, the liability is limited to $250,000. I would think that if they really thought that they were protected by Section 893.80, they would have put in here, oh, and by the way, nobody can get more than $50,000 against us because we're protected by statute. Rather, they say, we've gotten full coverage, $1 million primary, and $741 million sitting out there in the fund to cover anything that happens to you. And Mr. Van Sicklin just said, gee, we'd have a problem bringing doctors into the hospital. The fact of the matter, and I know you know this, is that our medical malpractice system in Wisconsin is absolutely the best. There is no state in the union that where a doctor never, ever has to pay one penny out of the doctor's pocket. And these doctors who go to the authority to work or to be residents are protected to $741 million. If I were any doctor in the country, I'd be scrambling to the authority to work here. And one other thought, because Justice Prosser asked a question, how do people know about limited liability at the hospital? In my opinion, if you should go along with this argument and say 893.80 relates to what goes on by the residents, and if you're a person in Madison having to decide between going to Meritor, St. Mary's, or the UW, and you know at the UW your maximum recovery if you're injured by an employee is $50,000, and we all know there's a lot of injuries being caused by medical negligence, you go to Meritor, you go to St. Mary's. They're asking for something that in reality may adversely affect the UW because they're asking to have this limited liability so patients who are injured are going to go home with no compensation. And we all know no lawyer is going to take a medical malpractice case if the maximum recovery is $50,000. You can't do that. So what they're asking for is complete immunity. If you go to the UW, you're injured by a nurse or by a resident, you're never, ever going to see the light of day. You're not going to be able to bring a case. So my request is that you abide by your holding in the Reineck decision. It was very clear on its face. This is a Chapter 655 proceeding. They're paying 655 dues. They've admitted that. This is not an 893.80 situation. And any questions?
No. Just one. They cannot coexist. In other words, 893.80 cannot stand because of 655.
Their 893.80 only applies to the corporate, the things we were talking about.
As far as additional information, a letter brief or something, do you have any objection to that?
I don't. You know, I started out my talk today by apologizing for you for not having thought about this early on, and I feel badly about that. I feel badly that we went through all of this briefing about what does this mean, what does that mean. And I guess my last comment is, if in fact the legislature intended the authority to be subject to 893.80, why wouldn't the legislature say that? Why wouldn't they say, we want, you know, they started this whole chapter of the statutes, Chapter 233. If they wanted the authority to be protected, all they had to do is say, and by the way, any claims brought against the authority have to go through Section 893.80.
Thank you, Mr. And, and thank you, Mr. Van Sicklin, for yet another very interesting discussion of medical malpractice, and notice to the authorities. So with that, we complete our hearing in 05-AP-2743. We are in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45. The court will meet in the conference room at 3:15. I'm sorry, just a minute. We are in recess. Thank you.